Show. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. So let's try this again. It's 18 minutes past the hour of 7 p.m. here in the Eastern Daylight Time Zone. Still a little bit of light left in the sky here in the hills and hollers of almost level West by Cole, Virginia. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn. It's Friday on the front porch, only we're missing about an hour and 18 minutes of it. I don't know why. The White Rose Society stream server decided to, I don't know, maybe it took a cyber vacation or something. Who knows what an hour and 18 minutes is to the mind of a server. That could be 2 weeks on the Mayan Riviera for all I know. Yeah, let's not even start thinking about it. Hi! Yeah, Bob Kincaid did that, right, yeah. So it is Friday on the front porch. It's 19 past the hour. We're a little late getting started, but better late than never, right? I can't stand to be away from the microphone if I don't have to be. So no sooner had I put out a tweet that said we're toast for Friday on the front porch than, lo and behold, I don't know. We have incredibly talented people associated with The Horn, not the least of whom is Ben Burt. Ben was out on the road driving and couldn't do a darn thing with the server. We were just whipped. And so I said, we're toast. But because Ben communicates on a, I think he communicates on a subatomic level with technology, I think the server heard him cursing from miles and miles and hundreds of miles away, and decided it had better get back in good with the user. Yeah, we've got that's the beauty of this whole community here. We've got a great group going, assuming there's anybody listening at all now. We've got a great group going this evening in the Horn chat room, which you can be a part of by going over to headonradionetwork.com/chatroom, picking yourself out a screen name and a password, and jumping into the rollicking, roiling good time that is the Horn multimedia real-time experience. Good evening to Anatole and to Carol, Abel, and chatroom Jesus. Good evening to Kathy and Laborman and Mad Mike in South Carolina. Good evening to our third stage guild navigator, Sparky, who is both Sparky and Man Cave, having folded space this evening. Good evening to Texas T and Todd and Truth Seeker and Waggy. Waggy checking in from Matafreakin' Gascar. You just love technology, don't you? Yeah. Nothing short of amazing. And it's amazing the things I learn. I had a note earlier in the day from VJ, and it was one of those that just tickles me. Note came in from VJ, and he said, "I just needed to tell you how great your show was yesterday. I just finished listening to the podcast and haven't laughed so hard in a while, especially your Lindsey Graham impersonation. Help me, John." By the way, not sure if you know this already, and meant to say it, but the name of the ancestral Graham plantation, Smoldering Chode, was interesting because chode in Hindi means fucker. Thank you VJ. No, VJ. Thank you immensely. Because while I was playing with some sort of colloquial terms, I love those little moments where I get to find out that there really is a connection, because chode has a very similar meaning in colloquial English. It means, you know, wider than it is long. And there it is. It turns out it's a real live word in Hindi, which, of course, is related. It's part of the whole Indo-European language group tree, whatever. And there's our ancient kinship. So, yes, anytime we refer to Lindsey Graham, I'm sure all interviews with Lindsey Graham will come from the veranda of, which also is another South Asian word, is it not? It will come from the veranda of smoldering, of the ancestral plantation, smoldering chode in the low country of South Carolina. So that's thank you very kindly, VJ, for making my afternoon with that comment. So let's thanks to everybody who emailed me to say you're off the air. I appreciate it, I really do. And thanks for everybody sticking around inside the chat room. I do sincerely appreciate it. Because I look forward to our Fridays. Now, what else do we have? We are listener supported here at the Horn, and I'll just put this out there, and hopefully things will simply fall into place thereafter. We have a chance to get a little bit out front. Did a bunch of bill paying this week, and a bunch more coming next week, and some from this week to finish off. It would be nice if we got a nice running start out front on things. We try to raise $150 every evening. That would be a great thing to have happen this evening. And if we could get, we were way out front on this week till Wednesday, but that would be really, really helpful if we could. So don't wait. You don't necessarily have to wait around for if we raise the amount necessary on one given night. Jump right in. The PayPal interface is at headonradionetwork.com. You know that. You know that you don't have to fill in the really, really intrusive portions of the first screen about, great granny fracas's corset size or anything like that. No, you just fill out enough to get to the next screen, because that's where all the choices take place. PayPal, Visa, MasterCard, what have you. So, all help is good help. $5 at a time, $1 at a time, it doesn't matter. And I will thank you all very much in advance. So, since we did get a late start on the evening, let's jump over to, let's at least sort of bring things up to close to being on schedule, and jump over to the Horn Molloy Skype chat group. Of course, if you've never been part of the Horn Molloy Skype chat group, you can. And you can do that by sending a contact request on Skype, which is really easy to use. It's just a matter of downloading it onto your computer, and then it'll walk you right through the setup and everything. Send a contact request on Skype to Sparky Dunk. Sparky Dunk on Skype. And Sparky, who has for years and years and years and years now moderated the Horn Molloy Skype chat group, will get you all set up. Thank you. A note coming from the marvelously coherent Diane in Kansas Stan. Listening in Kansas Stan and glad. Thank you, Diane. Thank you very kindly. And so with all that having been said, hey, Sparky.
Hey, Bob.
I'm in a much better place with my head now, because earlier I was just screaming all those Yosemite Sam swear words.
I should have sent you a notice before the show that I was getting nothing on the stream. I didn't. I just came in from the man cave because I couldn't do it out there today because the band was so low on the cable. So I came inside to do the Skype thing. But
Well, I had a note from Sylvia right before airtime, and see, I'm sitting here looking at it, and it looks like streaming, happy. And unless I connect, which then I run the risk of shutting the stream down by connecting to it. But anyway, unless I connect, I don't know. I guess at some point in time I'm going to have to set up an air monitor just to know when it's rolling and when it's not.
Well, I'll send you a heads up next time if I notice it.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, is anybody going to call in on the Gizmo line tonight?
I heard from Bill earlier when it became obvious that I was not on the air. Bill pays attention to these things, and he may or may not. I don't know if he continued to monitor to see if we ever made it back to air or not. So the Gizmo line is open, 304-663-HORN. Thank you for reminding me, Sparky. Anybody that wants to connect telephonically can use that for Friday on the Front Porch. Nice group you got gathered together this evening, Sparky.
Well, I tried. Carol was a no earlier, but I sent her a message that you're on air. So.
Okay. Yeah. Good evening. Good evening to the chat group. Let's say howdy to Waggy in Madagascar. Hey, Waggy.
Hello. How are y'all?
Doing good. Doing good. What? 3:30 in the morning there?
2:30 now. Yeah.
Well, you sound bright-eyed and bushy-tailed.
Took a little nap before.
Oh, very nice, very nice. So, did I understand you correctly in the chat room that you and your beloved are trying to work your way back to the States now?
That is the plan. We're working through the immigration process. Homeland Security cleared it and sent it to the State Department, which apparently they sent an entire avalanche of applications all at once, so things are a little bit backed up there.
Ah, bureaucracy. What a lovely thing it is.
Mm-hmm.
And good evening to Sentient Steve up in Canada.
Hi there, Bob. How are you doing?
Doing good, doing good. Thanks for joining us this evening. Carol Abel is in Australia. Good evening, Carol.
Aye, aye, sir. And we're all aboard this boat.
Yep, and we're all bozos on this bus. I also got a note from Robert in Australia saying loud and clear in Oz. He said, I just checked every 15 minutes until you came on. I don't have Twitter or Facebook. And I understand. There's a lot of people who don't. And so... In that instance, it's really, really hard to. Never mind. Might do something with the website, but I don't know. There's work to do over there too. There's just too much work for too few people, really. Good evening, Jeffrey in the Netherlands. How are you?
Hi. Good evening. I'm okay. Checking out the show. I was waiting earlier. I thought. I thought the White Rose was done. So.
Well, it was, and apparently the mere fear that the server's mere fear that it will be glowered at by Ben Birch was enough to send it back into a state of righteousness. So good. And a new contributor or a new conversationalist in the group this evening. Good evening, Rick.
Hey, Bob, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. How are you? Welcome to the gang.
You bet. I'm out here in Los Angeles, actually.
Ah, sunny and dry.
Very dry, yeah. My skin especially.
Yeah, drier than James Bond's martini.
There you go. You got it. I feel like I know you guys. I've listened to you for probably 3 or 4 years on the delayed stream. And I usually listen to the Norman Goldman show from 3 to 6 p.m. Pacific time. I guess I'm 3 hours behind you guys. but decided to finally jump in and you know, have a little conversation here with the group. We've got a great group of folks here, from what I can, from what I've heard.
Oh, it's a merry crowd every Friday, and you know, most days during the week. We just don't do the whole group thing except on Fridays. Well, and look at that, three years of lurking, and then lo and behold, and you haven't passed out or fainted or keeled over or anything yet. So, you know, note that it can be done.
Very possible. You got it.
What's your temperature down there today, Rick?
I think it was like 80 when I got into the office today, about 11 o'clock, so it's probably 85 by now. How about you up there in near Reading, I guess?
85 degrees.
Okay, okay.
It's going to be 91 tomorrow.
Whoa. Yeah, we're going to go right from winter to summer, I think. That's sort of the way it goes sometimes, you know?
What winter?
Yeah, right. Exactly. Oh, gosh. Hey, I was going to mention, I see Waggy's picture on the stream here, and he looks so much like a cat that I had named Gizmo. He lived to be about 20 years old. He had renal failure, and we had to give him fluid treatments 2 to 3 times a week at the very end, but it's like a dead ringer for Gizmo.
he's a shapeshifter, our Waggy is.
There you go.
Ah, yes, that was Diana. She's passed on also.
Ah, my condolences.
We've got a couple other people that use cats as avatars that aren't on here tonight. Carol Baker and her sister.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, Carol's always got stuff to say.
I got a message from Gerald. He's outside working on his boat, so he won't be joining us tonight.
Oh, too bad. Well, yeah, working on his boat. Probably getting ready to go fishing.
Can you still fish in the river there?
Yeah, you just don't eat it. You just don't eat it. I mean, you know, it might come out of the river. Well, the streams there near mountaintop removal sites, we started calling them the Homer Simpson fish several years ago. You remember the original opening to The Simpsons where he throws the nuclear fuel rod and it bounces and goes into the stream, and a little bit later you see the three-eyed fish? That's the Homer. Well, we get fish with multiple eyes, crooked spines, two heads, you know, all kinds of fun stuff, thanks to the filth that pours off of mountaintop removal sites.
Well, it's a shame. I mean, you can't really fish anywhere anymore.
Well, what? Practically every stream in the United States is impaired to one degree or another by mercury poisoning.
Yeah, and the streams here in California got a lot of mercury put in them from the gold miners in the 1800s. You can still find it in the streams if you dredge it up in the overburden.
Well, speaking of gold mining, I noticed a story coming out of, Oregon the other day? The Bundyites were going to go up and keep the jackbooted thug government from putting its jackbooted thug boots on freedom. And the gold miner in question in Oregon said, no, stop. This is not the Bundy. Because as soon as the birthers, ninthers, deathers, tenthers, baggers, and booger eaters all got up there, the guy in question said, nah, no thanks. Why don't you guys go home?
I thought he was going to have a big to-do on the anniversary down there at his ranch.
Well, I don't know, but this,
I know they got that bill going in Nevada that they want the state to start taking land back from the federal government.
Well, this case out of Oregon was at least moderately humorous because they found out real quick that they didn't want the freedom protectors up there working the case. Because they went up there and started playing their little Bundy games, and that didn't work out so good. I'm looking at it right now. As soon as the computer lets me scroll, there we go. Yeah, according to the thing, the account posted at Raw Story, the owner of a southwestern Oregon mining claim embroiled in a land use dispute with the Bureau of Land Management asked militia groups Thursday afternoon to stop sending volunteers to back him against government agents. And this is a quote from Rick Barkley, co-owner of the Sugar Pine Mining Claim. We don't need any more volunteers. We're not under attack. This is not the Bundy Ranch. Please stop calling the BLM and threatening their personnel. So inherent in that statement is the fact that the, you know, birthers, deathers, ninthers, tenthers, baggers, booger eaters, perchers, libertarians, and whatnot have picked up the phone to dial the Bureau of Land Management and say, oh, it's going to be a revolution, and we're taxed enough already because we're Tea Partiers, and we're going to defend freedom and Wolverines, damn it, and we'll put a bullet in you, bust a cap in you. Right.
Well, I don't know how it works now, but back in the day when we had a mining claim, we had an association of claims, 20-acre claims on the Trinity River, and we had to register them with the county and pay taxes on the claim, but all we had rights to were the mineral rights. And the Forest Service, we had a cabin on the property, and a cable car that went across the river and everything. We sold it to a guy from San Diego. And then the BLM and Forest Service went in there a couple of years after my dad sold it to this guy, and they burned the cabin down.
See, that's what Blaine Cooper, an Arizona State Militia member, said earlier in the week. We need people, so get down here. And we need press. We need people to come in here. We're going to give these people a fair shot because it could mean their life. The BLM is not to be trusted. As we have seen, their track record is not good at all. They have burnt down people's cabins out here, okay? So they're tyrants, period. So we need your help, Merca. And the, you know, the Oath Keepers are involved. And, well, sooner or later, somebody's going to holler Wolverines.
Yeah, well, they did that basically, not just because of the mining claims back then, but it was because of the pot growers.
Oh, well. Yeah, I imagine there is a little horticulture going on up there.
Oh, in Trinity County, yeah, it's big time. Big time, anyway.
So where's Trinity County relative to, like, Humboldt and where you are? And
well, Trinity County butts right up to Humboldt County. It's inland. And it has the Trinity River runs through it. And then it's the mountain range that it has there are called the Trinity Alps.
Right, I've heard of those.
And that's where the river, the headwaters of the river are. And it's a recreation wildlife area you can go hiking in and stuff.
Sounds like it must be beautiful.
Oh, it is.
Hey, Sparky.
Mm-hmm.
Does Bigfoot live in the Trinity area?
Well, yeah.
That's what I thought. It's very remote, isn't it?
Yeah, there used to be big old people used to do chainsaw sculptures of Bigfoot, put them alongside the highway.
Yeah,
and
cool.
You know, the little tourist attractions, everything. The main place is up near Willow Creek, which is right near Trinity, Humboldt, and Siskiyou County line, and there's an Indian reservation up there, Hoopaw Indians.
Okay.
So that's the main area where Bigfoot supposedly roamed.
Okay. That's beautiful country up there, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. It's really, you know, mountainous. Except where the rivers run through.
But yeah, well, you've got to stay close to the rivers. Otherwise, there's the civilization's always closer to the rivers, I know. So, you know, that's the key in those wilderness areas, to find the river and follow it. If you get lost, that is.
There's a lot of white water rafting up there. And then Arnold Schwarzenegger put the kibosh on suction dredging.
What's that? Oh, to dredge the dredging the riverways or what?
Yeah, you used to be able to have mining claims on the river.
Oh, that's right.
And you should be able to put in, you know, motor-operated dredges.
Oh, right.
Like my dad had an 8 and a 6. Yeah, 8-inch dredge was run by a Volkswagen engine, and then 6-inch dredge was run by a Honda engine.
Okay, I remember seeing that when I was rafting down the American River one time, like this is years ago, 20 years ago, and I remember the motorized dredges. It was actually kind of annoying to hear that sound in that beautiful wilderness area, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that's one thing, one good thing that the Governator did.
Yeah, but it was to a lot of people, it was a recreation and a hobby.
Right.
They enjoyed it. I mean, my dad enjoyed it from 1959 to 1991. Because he got so old he couldn't do it anymore. Well, he messed up his knee one time up there on the river. He was like 71 or 72 when he quit.
Ah. Well, that's, you know, he was able to dredge for a long time.
He met some interesting people.
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, some people probably just make a living off of that as well, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, he got to meet the guy down at Key West that used to do the shipwreck things. Mel Fisher.
Oh, okay.
And that was in 1959. He first met him, and then in 1983, we drove down there with a friend of his that did this special helicopter gold scope thing or something. It could detect metal from the helicopters.
Hmm.
And he was flying around out there from Key West. He was trying to locate more shipwrecks.
Wow. Interesting.
Well, there's an abundance of them still out there.
Mm-hmm. But he used kind of the technology with the dredge to put the a tube over the prop to blow the prop wash down on the ground to wash the sand away.
Now, does that have a pretty deleterious effect on the environment, Sparky, or not, as far as the river and the cleanliness of the water and that kind of thing? Obviously, it obscures the visibility.
Well, the fish used to just feed like crazy off the end of the sluice boxes.
Hmm.
My mom used to catch trout off the end of the sluice boxes when we were running.
Hmm.
But all you were doing is sucking the gravel and everything out of the bottom of the river and putting it through a sluice box and then depositing it back in the river.
Okay.
And probably stirring up some foodstuffs that, yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, when the floodwaters come along, I mean, if you've ever been to high water on a river, like when the river is really high and raging, you can hear the boulders moving by the water in the river.
Kind of like a clickety clack sound, sort of. Probably.
Yeah, I mean the hydraulic effect of the water.
Yeah, yeah.
So the floods would go through there and change the banks, but the gold catched in the bedrock and in crevices and stuff.
Right, right. Hmm. So did you have luck at gold mining then yourself, Sparky, or not?
Well, I just did it with my dad. I mean, he kept all the gold.
Dad's a...
He didn't pay you a wage?
No, I'd go up and work when I was unemployed. I'd go up there and help him.
Yeah.
Sometimes, and then... I got into the trade hot and heavy, and I didn't mind with him that much. I'd just go back up on weekends and stuff, and he had another partner.
Okay.
Till he quit. Had a buddy that was in the pile drivers union with him that helped him for several years.
Did he make a pretty decent living off of that or not?
He made enough to pay for his gas, basically.
Okay.
And I've still got about maybe eight ounces of gold here.
Okay.
Coming out of the rivers that he didn't sell, and he gave away his biggest finds. And my sister ended up with the biggest nugget he got, which was over an ounce. It was on a bolo tie clip.
Oh, cool. Cool.
Well, I wanted to jump in and thank Jan and Jerry for getting us started this evening. We just heard from them out in Vegas, so we're off and running for the evening. A couple of things worth thinking about this evening, just because, well, they're fun and it might make us run screaming into the night or reach for the hockey puck. I had a note from Robert in Morgantown prior to the show saying that the Reverend Pastor Brother Governor Mike Huckstraby was said to be announcing his presidential intentions on Fox News TV Radio Rwanda this evening. So I can imagine we're all sitting around with bated breath waiting. No, not really, huh? No.
No, you got to be kidding, Bob.
Well, I mean, I personally would like to see a steel cage, chain mail glove, no two walk in, only one walks out, wrestling death match between him and Ted Cruz for the support of the evangelical fundamentalist bunch. I mean, come on, that'd be a blast, wouldn't it?
So Hunkle Buck is gonna announce that he's gonna run for president.
Well, or whether he will.
Oh.
Well, I hear there was a big doings up in New Hampshire today.
Oh yeah.
With Christie and Mark Rubio and Jeb Bush, I think.
Did anybody get their nose busted or anything?
No, it was a government, you know, it was a GOP party meeting thing or something.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, invitation only.
And no cameras to pick them up talking about the 47% moochers or anything. Darn.
More than likely.
You know, it's amazing, Bob, although I understand it, that we're such a large country, we have so much wealth here, but we're so disconnected from the rest of we're so disconnected socially and culturally, it seems, from the rest of Europe and Asia and Africa. When we talk about things here in this country, it's as if we're the only country that matters. We're the only country that exists, and we don't see ourselves as part of a world system.
No, because, well, the rest of the... Larry, the rest of the world isn't exceptional like we are. I mean, there's no... Don't kid yourself. I mean, there's no exceptionalism in Canada. There's no exceptionalism in Great Britain or Germany or Italy Turkey or Sweden or Australia or Japan or China. We're the only country in the world that has exceptionalism, and I mean, we've got all of it here. I mean, we're so exceptional that you know, we can sacrifice children so that paranoid maniacs can have semi-automatic firearms. I mean, that's a lot of exceptionalism. Meanwhile, there is stuff that goes on in the wider world. Everybody knows what an archaeology nerd I am. Saw a story earlier today. The ongoing work to sort out just where humanity comes from has taken another leap back into the past. It used to be that we thought the oldest human or hominid-made tools were about 2.5 million years old. Well, now there's a discovery being announced in science that if it turns out to be for real and all the data turns out to be solid, that hominid creatures were making stone tools 3.3 million years ago. I mean, I remember...
Yeah, that pushed back.
Yeah, I remember when I was in college learning about Lucy, you know, which was what, Homo habilis? No, she was an Australopithecine, wasn't she?
That's right.
You know, that was 2 million years, so we've pushed it back by 1.3 million years. And once again, it'll be time for Ken Ham to come out and declare that those are Satan's tinker toys that he, little baby Satan, played with in his sandbox in order to confuse the unbelievers.
Yeah, I also saw another headline. I didn't read the article, but just saw the headline this week that chimpanzees have been caught hunting with using spears.
Yeah,
so it pushes the whole idea of you know, what's uniquely human again?
Right, and of course we've known about chimpanzees and what are they called, dibbling sticks? We've known about those for a very long time, where they'll take a thin stick and maybe lick it or something and put it in a termite hole, and it'll come out covered with termites, which then they will, yummy. Yeah, tool use. Yeah, but then again.
Yeah, and birds have been
crows
doing that.
Too. Yeah, crows are tool users, are they not?
Mm-hmm. Well, Devin sent me a really interesting documentary yesterday about Guy McPherson, and I watched it. It was about a half an hour long, and he's talking about how, and the woman who was narrating most of it, you know, they've been doing activism for a long time, but they basically thought that they're really based upon what we haven't done up to now, that there may not be anything that we can do to save save any environment. So you know, I watched that, and then you know, do you know who Guy McPherson is? That's a person that Devin seems to, gets a lot of, interesting information from. Do you know who he is, Bob?
I'm familiar, but not deeply familiar.
Yeah. But, he was talking about how eventually the world will go dark, or the planet will go dark. That we basically have to go back to a nomadic existence to save the planet, which, you know, it makes sense to me. I mean, I can't see that, you know, I don't have a crystal ball, but he was saying that a lot of our practices have got to change, and we've got to go back to a nomadic way of living in order to save the planet.
Yeah, who's going to volunteer to do that, Larry?
In a sense, with children leaving families to go find work and then going from state to state to state just to try to remain employed.
Yeah, I guess that would be nomadic capitalism, Waggy.
Yeah.
Well, that's some kind of super version of it.
Oh, by the way, quick update. Reverend Governor Pastor Brother Mike Huxterby is playing the long con. This evening he announced that he will announce his absolute presidential plans on May 5th in Hope, Arkansas.
Oh.
Can't wait for that.
Yeah, his hometown, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wish that Devin were on the call because we're in the chat room, because he could refute or support whatever it is that I've just said. It would be
well,
helpful,
I personally am praying, please, Mike Huckabee, please run for president. Pretty please. Because, I don't think anybody who's ever been to the circus knows that the more clowns in the car, the cooler the clown car act is.
I want a double decker clown car bus.
Well, ultimately,
like,
yeah.
12 candidates.
I mean, yeah. Come on, Ben Carson. Come on, Donald Trump, and that thing on your head. Come on. Come on. Get along now.
How about the pizza man?
Oh, no. He translated his 15 minutes of fame into a radio gig and he will never, ever, ever leave that. By the way, the marvelously coherent Diane in Kansas, Stan, with an email, tool user, the possums go into my detached garage and unplug my electric tools. I think maybe we've got some radical environmentalist possums there.
So, Bob, that begs the question, if all these clowns are going to run on the Republican side, who do we support on the Democratic side, especially since the one Democrat that's announced, or the one major one that's announced, is still prosecuting wars in Iran and has ties to the...
She's not prosecuting anything. She's not in any office.
Well, she's been...
I mean, right?
But...
Oh no,
yeah.
She's hawkish, and
Hold on.
There's all kinds of stuff to object to out there. By the same token, she's also been getting real cozy lately with Senator Warren, and Senator Warren's been getting cozy with her. So does that mean Senator Warren is a bloodthirsty warmonger too? Is that how it's going to play out?
No, I think Hillary's just looking for progressive partners.
Well, because she knows that the biggest problem that she has is on the progressive side, well, you know, what Howard Dean called the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party.
She can probably get out there and raise some money for Hillary, because she's got to raise a boatload of money.
Now, somewhere the conversation shifted from Hillary to Elizabeth Warren, or Hillary to Elizabeth Warren. Okay, well,
Elizabeth Warren is helping Hillary
actively endorsing.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I think Waggy caused that shape-shifting of the conversation myself.
This is about Waggy shape-shifting the conversation.
Podcast, Larry, podcast.
Okay.
Marty noting, wait, so Hucksterby is going to make us wait until May the 5th, Cinco de Mayo? Will we be drinking in celebration or drowning our sorrows, and which is which? Well, there ain't going to be no drinking at the celebration there in Hope, Arkansas, Because lips that touch liquor will never touch Hucksterby's. Max. Right? you mean Hucksterby's lips? No, Hucksterby's liquor. All you can do is strap in it. You know, we bought the ticket. We'll take the ride.
I hope they have like 10 debates like they had last time, but I don't think they're going to this time around, unfortunately.
That guy who sounds like something, whose name sounds like something you get from a nasty toilet seat, rinse penis or whatever. he said there's not going to be nearly so many debates, and that's just a pity.
Yeah, especially since they won't let third party candidates go get into the debates.
Larry, time out. Why would a third-party candidate be allowed to debate in a primary debating situation?
Because people need to hear...
No, Larry, they're primaries. Do you know what primaries are? Primaries are nominating processes.
Okay, I understand. Okay. Sorry.
You get it, right? For the general, yeah, then that's where you launch that objection.
Okay.
Not in the primaries.
Okay.
Because a primary process is the process by which a party nominates a person to be its nominee in the contest.
Yeah, that's the only process where the two parties explicitly decide to agree with each other. They may decide to agree with each other implicitly about foreign policy in this country, but about explicitly about where they get together and file suits against third parties to keep the Democrats and the Republicans work together to keep third party candidates out of the
Well, what third party candidate? What third party candidate? You, I mean, let's just let's extrapolate out into November, into the 2016 general election campaign, you know, about September-ish. What third party candidate should be in a debate?
Whichever party has a candidate that happens to be that happens to be running, whether it's Green.
Okay, the Constitution Party will be running some wild-eyed Christian Reconstructionist who wants to stone the gays to death. You want that person in the debate?
If I would let one third party candidate in, I'd kind of have to let all of them in. Right.
And that's exactly the point. Once you've opened that barn door, everybody comes in, and then it just turns in. And then it just turns into a daggum carnival, doesn't it?
Kind of like a California governor's race.
Yeah, that was a kick. I remember there was a porn star that was actually running for governor that year.
Oh. Yeah, wasn't that during the recall?
Exactly.
I guess the point I'm making is that the terms of discourse, of political discourse, are so narrow between the main parties. I mean, they don't have there's not a lot of difference. There are some differences, obviously, about domestic policy, but about foreign policy, they're not going to, they're not going to differ that much, at least the mainstream party folks. And foreign policy and the way we spend money for military contractors and that kind of thing, and some of the domestic policy issues, like how much we spend for oil and monopoly capitalism and all that. Those are big issues that are rarely ever talked about.
And they deserve to be talked about, Larry, but here's the other side of that coin. Should people be in the debate who do not have a lots of zeros, 1% chance of actually winning the contest? I mean, Jill Stein's got great ideas. But she does not have a wax cat's chance in hell of winning.
Mm-hmm.
Whoever the libertarians nominate doesn't have a wax cat's chance in hell of winning. So really, in terms of, I'll probably get hate mail over this, but really, given the fact that you said that the positions of both parties are kind of difficult to suss out and whatnot, don't you think that shouldn't the debate be in terms of affording the greatest opportunity to suss out those differences?
Okay, I see what
you're
saying.
Instead of having some dead from the neck up, dadgum libertarian off on one side hollering, "Yeah, but if we just go back to the gold standard, Andy."
Well, I'd like to hear, I don't know how I can really answer that, because I'm frustrated with both parties.
Who's not?
I'd like to hear from the rest of the group, because I don't think I can give you a coherent answer that would be satisfactory to me as to why I would,
I just have this vision of the Constitution Party's nominee standing up there in that very somber tone and saying, "Well, if my people, which are called by my name, will pray unto God, then God will bless this nation, and we can keep those demon women from killing the precious little fetuses." When what's really on the table is whether or not a 67-year-old is going to have to live to be a 69-year-old to collect Social Security.
Yeah. Okay, so you'd like to have two candidates from the major parties who will concentrate on the major issues.
Well, it's not what I like, it's what's going to happen. Nobody's calling Bob to find out.
Okay. I didn't get a chance. I haven't had a chance to ask Rick yet where in Los Angeles he actually is.
Well, I'm sitting in Westwood right now in my office, but I live north of town in the foothills.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Yeah, because my family's from the San Fernando Valley.
Okay, I live in the other valley, the Crescenta Valley.
Okay.
Which is just north and east of the San Fernando Valley, as you may know.
And where is that relative to Cucamonga?
That's
a joke.
Miles.
That's a joke, Rick. That's a joke. And Cucamonga.
Well, Rancho Cucamonga is way over there in San Bernardino.
Yeah, that was just a funny, Larry.
I know. And Rancho Cucamonga. Yeah.
And you know, Pismo Beach. Pismo Beach was the home of Egbert Suse, W.C. Fields, the Bank Dick. Look at that man's nose, Mommy. It's not nice to make fun of people, son. You'd like to have a nose like that full of nickels, wouldn't you?
So
nights I used the 10 bar.
So, Bob, are we as voters just going to have to deal with the insane Republicans going against the somewhat extremely cynical Democrats this time around and just have to go through week after week or commercial after commercial of this kind of stuff?
Yeah.
When are we just going to have to deal with it?
Yeah.
Ugh. That's not...
Larry, right now is a silly season.
Yeah, but...
The people are out there, I mean, trying to get money from people to see if they can run a viable campaign. Like Bernie Sanders says, he said one time, I heard him, he said, I'd have to raise $300 million just to start a viable campaign.
Yeah, because it's not a joke that it's going to take $2 billion to run the, and you know what, by 2020, it'll be a $4 billion campaign. And again, I urge people to look at it in the terms that I'd mentioned a night or so ago. This is the political campaigns in the United States, especially national presidential ones, are quadrennial exercises in wealth redistribution from the $3 at a time bunch upward to the $1 billion shrimp fork bunch.
I'm just wondering when we're going to have our first corporation run for president, Bob.
It's a good question.
Well, that's happening in everything, but in all but name only, is it not, Rick?
Well, that's true. That's true. They might as well wear patches, like Coke Industries, Mr.
Well,
Walker.
And I mean, let's say let's.
I'll be right back. I got a salesman coming to the door.
Shoot him. I mean, let's say it winds up being Scott from Fitzwalker Stan versus Hillary. Well, that's going to be Koch Brothers versus Goldman Sachs, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty much.
I mean, it's rollerball. At this point, I don't know how old you are, Rick, but you might be old enough to remember the original James Caan version of rollerball.
Oh yeah, I think I'm 52. We're the same age, I think, Bob.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's a great movie. I remember that.
Yeah, you are about the same age.
Yeah.
By the way, I think we can, at least in this group, we can say that we shouldn't be calling this country or this government a democratic government any longer. Now, I know I'm saying the obvious, but I wish we'd stop calling it a democracy.
Just use my operative phrase. In the United States of America, always, democracy has been aspirational and not operational.
Yeah.
I mean, when you've got the actual framers of the Constitution declaring that democracy is whatever we say it is, because they did that. James Madison said, democracy is what we say it is. He said, no, we're not going to have people directly electing the president, and no, they're not going to directly elect the senators, but they're going to get to directly elect somebody who elects them, so we'll say that that's democracy, okay?
So I guess, like most people are saying, or have said for decades, as long as the stormtroopers aren't coming to our doors and arresting us and carting us off for saying whatever we want to say or doing at least a little, for at least having some kind of life. I guess we ought to be grateful given the nature of how the... So I guess we ought to be grateful that we have the freedom to be able to at least speak our minds to some extent. But when
right, because it's the greatest country in the world on earth.
Yeah, well, I was watching the Going Dark movie yesterday, and as I said earlier, at the wrong time, because I usually jump into these things while we're having a discussion about something else with another topic, that in the Going Dark movie they showed Hillary Clinton giving a speech, and they showed Ray McGovern being carted off by security guards and beaten up because he protested or made some comments during the Hillary Clinton speech. And they've even tasered or beaten up people that have gotten up and heckled or gotten up to challenge publicly somebody speaking while they're speaking.
Do you remember Don't Tase Me, Bro?
Yes, I remember that. Don't Tase Me, Bro. Yes, I remember that.
Hey, let me jump over here because I've been horribly remiss. Bless his heart. Jim in Louisiana, Stan, has been waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting over on the gizmo line, and I've been a total idiot. Hey, Jim.
Hey, Bob.
I'm sorry I made you wait, brother.
That's all right. It was weird because I turned on, I was trying to get you on the radio, on the internet, and first you weren't there, so then I went and did something, and then I just flipped back on to see if it was on, but I was enjoying the conversation.
I'm glad you are. And you are still in Louisiana, Stan?
Yeah, until around Wednesday, yeah. And the weather looks a lot better. So, but yeah, it was, like I said, it was like 9 days straight of rain off and on, although today it's not raining. And it was, but it's like, where I live, you gotta go across, like I told you the other day, gotta get across the causeway, and the causeway was closed at one of the day before. And, I just created a whole bunch of havoc, so I just postponed it. So, one of the things y'all were talking about, I think it kind of reminded me of something Malloy was talking about, a year ago or something. The DGR, deep green resistance, what it would take to, basically kind of get to help heal the earth, and
Yeah.
Like you said, Bob, I don't see how society could adjust to it. I mean, maybe they could, but
Well, I always think back to that wonderful, great Talking Heads song, "Nothing But Flowers." We've caught a rattle. This was a parking lot. Now it's all covered in flowers. We've caught a rattlesnake. Now we have something for dinner. Yeah, I miss the honky tonks, Dairy Queens, and 7-Elevens. We're not, we are in no wise ready to, and I think that's why dystopian apocalyptic films capture so much of our imagination, because it affords us a little bit of catharsis for what I think is a very real fear for a lot of people who stop long enough to think about it. And I'm one of those weirdos who does, and there's probably a medication out there that would help. But I wonder how long it would take for the U.S. highway that runs for hundreds of miles that you can get on, a quarter of a mile from the fabulous Kincaid Mansion here. I wonder how long it would take for that to be overcome by weeds.
They had that show on the History Channel. It was actually pretty interesting. I don't know, a year or two, maybe three ago. The premise was what would happen to cities, what humanity just all died off of a big, some virus or something just killed all humanity, and how long it would take, the nature to claim back the area. What would happen to the buildings and structures, like they did it on Vegas, they did it, I think, on LA, and different areas. Yeah, it'll only take about 20-30 years, so maybe a little bit
Jim, it's Rick here. If I could jump in just real quickly. It was called Life After People. That was a really good show.
Yeah.
And I, I remember one episode where they focused on Chicago, and basically Wrigley Field had been basically turned into an orchard. I mean, there were just trees all over the place, and everything was, you know, all grown up, and it was an interesting idea. Anyway.
Because I think I caught every one, and like I said, they did. I think about 8 or 10 cities.
And you really don't have to speculate, because I remember that brilliant photographic series I saw from Detroit that showed. I mean, had the climate been a little more tropical, it would have been like Mayan pyramids being engulfed in vines and jungle growth.
Yeah, and then you also forget even things you take for granted, like dams and stuff. Without humans to run them, they break down in relatively short order. You know, they're talking 10, 20 years.
Well, I've got a bridge. I've got a bridge not far from me that is a little over a mile long. It's 876 feet above the New River, and I'm not complaining about it, but it requires constant maintenance and attention. Now, what happens when you can't do that anymore? I mean, this is not the part of the program where I encourage everybody to go out and buy specially packaged corn, freeze-dried beans and rice or anything, but really, you know, what? And I ask the question because, you know, we've got half of our body politic that thinks that would be really cool in the form of the Republican Party, you know, and we can sell off the bridges to the Kochs, and hedge funds can buy highways, and I mean, really, the state of Indiana sold off its turnpike to what, an Australian concern, and that's worked out nicely, not.
Yeah, several municipalities have sold, and I don't think, you know, sold bridges and stuff, which I never understand, because, I mean, it seems like they just ran it. There's a viable income because people need to get across that bridge and stuff. But it's just this, I'm going to call it a sickness, this disease called capitalism, or, you know, this capitalism on acid, you know, or speed. I guess speed would be a better metaphor.
Meth.
Yeah.
Well, here in L.A., for example... Oh, sorry about that. Here in LA, for example, USC, University of Southern California, engineered a deal whereby it got a 98-year lease of the Coliseum and the sports arena just south of downtown LA. And they basically took it away from the city, county, and state entity. So they're now in charge of managing it.
And for those who don't know, USC is a private school.
Exactly. Yeah, so that's fascism at work in my community, you know? And that was not publicized. There was, like, very little notice of the vote on the lease agreement. You know, the meetings were, you know, the meetings were supposed to be public, but they violated the Brown Act. That's the open meeting law here in California. And there's no sanctions. It's like, oh, okay, so they violated the Brown Act. The court eventually concluded, like, a year or two after the deal was done. Well, what are the remedies, you know?
Yeah, they watched the replay and declared no harm, no foul.
Right. Right, exactly.
I mean, it's not like anybody else was bidding on the Coliseum now, was it?
Well, there was another party that was thinking about basically taking over management, so there was no competitive bidding. So... happens in every level of government, it seems like.
They just go into numerous courses of how great capitalism is and see how everything works out. You know, like even when they take over, it's just like when they take over a prison system. You know, and you know that's not good. You know that, you know, it just make a bad situation a hell of a lot worse. You know, there's no focus at all. It wasn't that much to begin with on rehabilitation. I can remember 30 years ago, there's kind of that question at least, and now it's just, you know, even, you know, punishment and just in to feed, then it becomes now to feed the prison industrial complex. Seems like everything becomes some sort of whacked out industrial complex. How can we profit off of other people's misery, misfortune, whatever?
That's the American way, unfortunately, I think, you know?
Yep.
Well, shouldn't capitalism's motto be act in haste, repent in leisure? Although I'm thinking here, specifically in the Coliseum situation, does that mean that if the NFL ever wanted to come back to L.A. and play in the Coliseum, that they'd have to rent it from USC?
Exactly.
Sweet!
No, they probably want a new one.
Yeah, they're talking about building a new one not far from the Staples Center, you know. So, I mean, I would prefer that there not be an NFL team, because that way I get to watch, like, you know, three or four games on a Sunday as opposed to, like, two games if there's a home team, you know, if we have a hometown team.
Oh, you're just selfish.
I know I am. More of a chance for my Bears to be on the TV.
I was going to say, you know, sure. And you are going to love watching every Browns game. Or, you know, how about every Jacksonville Jaguars game? Woohoo!
Oh, jeez. Oh, man.
So, USC...
So, Bob, I got...
Oh, go ahead, Rick.
Oh, Bob, I was going to ask you... I've been practicing attorney for about 25 years, and I've listened to your legal analysis on many shows, and you're almost always spot on. I mean, you're just as good as a practicing attorney, from what I could tell. And I know you prosecuted cases at one point in time. You just couldn't stomach it working for the state, or
I couldn't stomach it. At one point in time, I was. I was engaged in injured workers out of compensation. And like I said, you know, I learned 5 years prosecuting that basically we were engaged in punishing stupid people for being stupid. And I'm not saying all law violators are stupid, but we really did come to the conclusion, me and some friends, after the end of 5 years, that if the West Virginia legislature would just pass Article 99A, criminal dumbass, we could solve a lot of problems really quickly. You know, you just put the defendant on the stand, look at the jury, and go, you answer the question. Is he stupid, and did he do it? The jury goes, yeah, and we say, okay, now we'll work on a solution. But really, I mean, it's protect the money, manage the mean ones, and
keep order.
Well, basically, it was like a 3M kind of thing. Protect, but rule one is always protect the money. Manage the mean ones is number three, and I forget what my third one was. But you know, I like the academic study of it more. The trial work was fun, but that shit will eat you alive in a hurry. I always hated real estate more than anything else, because while it's fascinating, it is. I mean, there's a reason that the most successful real estate lawyers have a small army of paralegals who just live in the record room, because the lawyers don't want to be there, and all that dust and care. I mean, I admit, to go into some of the older counties and see those old handwritten deeds written in dipped pen copper plate script, God, it's gorgeous! And you feel like you're touching history. But, you know, I would rather, when he wrote The Innocents Abroad, A Tramp Abroad, Mark Twain said he ran in his essay, The Awful German Language, he said he ran into an old California chum who said he would rather decline two drinks than one German noun. And I feel that way about the rule against perpetuities, mortmain.
Yeah, no, real estate law is actually very boring. There's no doubt about that. So did you try criminal cases primarily, Bob, or what did you do?
Oh, yeah, for five years of criminal prosecution.
And then did you ever try your hand at private practice or anything like that or not?
Oh, yeah. Okay. I mean, I'm eating potatoed.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I was with the government for about 23 years. I was a tax attorney for the government, starting with the IRS for a few years, then U.S. Attorney's Tax Division, and now I'm in the private sector for the last 3.5 years. And I can definitely attest that the most unpleasant thing about the job is having to bill your hours all the time, you know, and having billable hour requirements. That definitely takes a lot of the fun out of life, you know.
Well, there's the old joke about the guy who... the lawyer who dies and goes up to the pearly gates, and you probably know it, Rick. And St. Peter says, the lawyer, he's died young, you know, he's 32 years old, and he says, seems kind of unfair, 32 years old, just getting started. St. Peter looks in the book and says, no, according to your billable hours, you're 506.
That's actually a new one to me. That's good. Or, you know, like the lawyer who's flying. Yeah. Okay. Got to cut out for just a second here.
Rick, can I? Rick and Bob.
Rick had to absent himself for a moment.
Okay. But you're talking about billable hours. There's a requirement by the firm that you're working for, the agency you're working for, to rack up a certain number of billable hours in order to keep employed or in order to meet some kind of quota. And he was talking about having to just put in time, and it would just drive. That was the most unpleasant part of the job. Is that, am I to infer that from what he's talking about?
Well, it's just kind of a niggling little, you've got to, it's frustrating because keeping up with your billable hours winds up being as time consuming as whatever it is you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there's software developers out there that try to make it simpler, and but really you divide hours into tenths, into little 6 minute segments.
So if you call up an attorney and talk to him for 6 minutes, they're going to bill you for 6 minutes, or I guess 5 minutes.
No, and they round up because if they talk to you for 6 minutes, Jim, they're going to bill you for two segments because it took them more than 6 minutes to be told that there was a call, and then it took them more than a minute to write down what they talked about on the call with you. So,
cool.
you always round up one more segment.
Oh man, it's just like everything is scanned.
I'm sorry?
It just seems like everything's a scam. That's all it is.
Well, Abraham Lincoln said a lawyer's time and advice are his stock in trade. And he's right. He was absolutely right. He's not selling you a jug of cider or doing any material thing. It's kind of like every now and then you'll hear somebody say, you know, and it's almost always from the right wing, well, I think law ought to be simple enough that any man can understand it, just like the Ten Commandments. Well, if you actually read the Old Testament, you'll find out that the Ten Commandments were not enough. There are, they branch out like webbing, and they have little offshoots and tangents, and yeah, it's not okay to steal, but you know what? It's okay to take food in order to continue surviving. There's all kinds of nuance involved. And so, you know, when somebody says that, you know, I used to look at him and say, well, yeah, and I think my body ought to be simple enough for that any human being could understand it and just cure themselves of all illness, and my car should be simple enough that, and then we wouldn't need doctors, and we wouldn't need mechanics, and we wouldn't need plumbers if everything was just simple.
Well, there's...
Can I say something real quick?
Yeah.
Okay.
I used to have explained myself to people when I go on a service call.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd walk in, and all the only problem was to reset their circuit breaker. I still had to bill them for an hour. And people go, well, you're only here 5 minutes. And I said, yeah, but I can't be working any. I drove here, and then I got to drive away from here to go somewhere else to go back to work. So you took an hour away from me.
So right,
and
lawyers will bill portal to portal.
Yeah. So, Bob, you started. You did law for 5 years from during the mid to late 1980s, or
no. It was starting in the early 90s.
Starting in the early 90s. Okay. Yeah. Well, you know, I can. But I know what I was going to ask. There's a press in Berkeley, and I haven't been there in over 15 to 20 years, called NOLO Press, and they start on a premise that, you know, law can be, you know, easily understood so that people don't have to go to you know about NOLO Press, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you feel about, do they perform a valuable service, or?
Remember that the law emerged from religious practice, Larry. And then eventually split away. I mean, you get, especially in the English common law system, which is different from code-based pleading on the European continent, you get the Court of King's Bench, and it evolves from there, and then you get the chancellor involved with equity to pick up the slack where the common law was found gap-ish. And there's a great deal of study that goes into it. The idea of an actual law school is fairly new. I mean, the last 150 years or so. And with that in mind, you know, it used to be, you know, Abe Lincoln's day, Thomas Jefferson's day, one became a lawyer by reading law with an older practitioner. So, theoretically, with a little bit of guidance, anybody can learn their way around. But what happens is people will trip over concepts that are really, really finely nuanced. And, you see it particularly in what are called jailhouse lawyer cases, where somebody who's incarcerated will get access to the prison law library and just start flooding, because, you know, they got nothing but time on their hands, they'll start flooding the courts with various and sundry forms of pleading that really mean things that they don't necessarily know it means. And that's, you know, that's where the trouble comes. Does that make any sense to you? So if you've got some if you've got some forms out there, you can conceivably use them to your benefit. But if you don't know what underlies them and you get into some kind of a problem, you're gonna be in a world of hurt in a hurry.
Okay.
Because I mean, there's no such thing as a true universal form, because every state in this union is a little country. From a legal standpoint, so the insurance laws of California are vastly different from the insurance laws of Ohio, and the motor vehicle laws of Oregon are wildly different from the motor vehicle laws of Florida, and that's why you have to pass bars in individual states to show competency inside a given jurisdiction. So if anybody's out there saying, you know, this is the form you need to do X, well, you really can't know that for certain unless you know what your jurisdiction's law says, you know, both case law and statutory law say about it. For instance, well, I mean, okay, something as simple as a will, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
I don't know if Rick's back yet. I guess not. A handwritten will is called a holograph. Okay, and if you, and every state is absolutely in charge because wills are a, you know, they're not a constitutional right. Wills are entirely a statutory construct. And so every state says what constitutes a will. How many witnesses, what the witnesses have to swear to, and even, you know, what it means if you know, Aloysius P. Jones sits down to write his own will. You know, the shaking hand and the feather quill and the piece of parchment, and I, Aloysius T. Jones, recognizing that my days upon this earth are numbered, and blah, blah, being mindful of my Maker, and yada, yada, yada. Well, he may get all the way to the bottom and sign it and fold it up and stick it in an envelope, and when somebody tries to probate it, the probate guy looks at it and goes, this won't do for a will.
Well, you know, Bob, I can tell you that I could try to go to law school, and I may still do it, but I don't know whether I could, based upon what I've heard from other, the few people that have practiced law, they're glad that they went through it while they went through it, but they don't want to ever go through it again. Or I talk with a lawyer, and I asked him about law school. He says, law school is a pie-eating contest to see how much pie you can eat. And then when you get out of law school, you're just going to eat more pie. So... I mean, if you can, explain.
No, I don't understand that analogy at all.
But,
because you know, the last thing they teach you in law school is how to be a lawyer. You know, that's why I've said in the past that law school is the ultimate liberal arts education. It is the pinnacle of the liberal arts education. And I mean a true broad spectrum liberal arts education. I'm not talking if you want to be the very best biologist you can be, you go and you get a PhD in biology.
Yeah.
But if you're somebody with a BS in biology and you've got a really quick study and you want to apply that across the spectrum, well, then off to law school with you. Because you'll apply what you know to everything. I mean, it's beautiful in that way, but law school, and you know, I'd love to hear from Cassie, who is, I guess, finishing up her first year now.
Mm-hmm.
It's intense. People can make themselves a neurotic mess there.
Yeah.
It's competitive.
If you
choose to compete. If you don't, doesn't matter. But there's a lot of people that show up there, you know, first day of law, by God, I'm going to be the editor of the Law Review, and I'm going to moot court and trial. And okay, good for you. Want a cookie? Because they don't, it's the same thing with medical school. They don't publish your graduating grade point average in the yellow pages. And I guess I'm being a bit anachronistic in even using the term yellow pages. The question is, you know, what kind of success can you have? What kind of track record do you have?
Mm-hmm.
Great criminal defense lawyers spreads pretty quickly. And there's always one that's the one that rises above all the others in any given community. There are some really awful old jokes out there, but I will refrain from telling them at this point in time, that illustrate the point.
Well, you know, Bob, there's at Cal Berkeley, they have an undergraduate degree called Legal Studies, where you take a course in substantive law, a course in legal theory, a course in administration of justice, and a course in comparative law. That's not law school. You got to get your BA. And then you go to law school after that. So I've also heard that when you're in legal studies, they teach you how to be critical of the law. And then when you go to law school, they wipe out all that stuff that you got in legal studies undergraduate or in your undergraduate education and teach you how to love the law. So you're not going to be critical at all of the law that you're studying.
Oh, no, Larry. No. Some of the loudest critics of the law are lawyers, because they recognize its inherent flaws. I remember having, for instance, a brilliant civil procedure professor who would sit there and tell us, about the evolution of pleading and how things that didn't turn, he was really good. He was Jesuit trained, and he brought in concepts of Platonic ideals, and illustrated it one day by holding up a styrofoam cup and saying everybody agrees that, this is a cup, and let's say this is a cause of action in the law. Everybody agrees that it's a cause of action. It's a cup. And he said, but then in the evolution of thinking about it, people began to wonder about, the Platonic ideal of cupness. What is it that constitutes a cup? And then he holds up a little disc. And he says, is this a cup? And he said, and the court says, no, that's not a cup. Get out of here. Case dismissed. And then he unscrews something and pops it out, and it's one of those little flattened down telescoping travel cups. And he goes, aha, it is a cup. And he said, that's what happens when courts recognize new causes of action. I mean, it's like, it's like the difference between a plate of green peas and green pea-ness. Sorry, couldn't resist. Wonderful joke. But with it, the law evolves and changes. Once upon a time, for instance, there was a concept known as so you start out with negligence. Negligence is doing or failing to do that thing which a reasonable person, reasonably prudent person in the same or similar circumstances would do or not do. Okay? And so when businesses, because it always turns on business, doesn't it? Remember, manage the money. Began being hit with negligence claims. The concept was invented called contributory negligence. And contributory negligence was a pernicious doctrine that said, if you've been hurt by somebody else, if you contributed even 1% to your own injury, then your recovery is barred. Because you have contributed your own negligence to the problem. So the court system then responded to that with comparative negligence, and in which you measure percentages of who got hurt, how much, why, where, whatever. And, some jurisdictions, like I think Alabama, still has pure contributory negligence. And it's nasty. In workers' comp, there's stuff like the fellow servant rule, which kept an employer from having to pay workers' comp on an injured worker if one of his fellow servants contributed to his injuries. Just nasty stuff, and it's a constant struggle. And right now we see it swinging back to the more hateful end of the spectrum.
Yeah, that being said, Bob, I'm not a lawyer and I don't play well on TV, but my two brothers are, and they're both civil law, and one sues corporations, the other one, his law firm defends them. But the point I was going to say is, I just remember when they went to law school, they spent, you go to law school, but then, 6, 7, 8 hours, even longer sometimes. Just going over those law books, and I don't know how, just to keep up with that, to read all that. Because I'm sure it's like anything else. Some stuff you read, I get into this, I understand this, yeah. And then other stuff you're like, what did I read? I don't get it. I mean, is that what it's like in law school?
Law school is just reading and reading and reading and analyzing and analyzing and analyzing. It's about learning how to do the research. It's about reading the cases and learning how to make the argument. And like I said, they'll teach you everything in the world in law school except how to be a lawyer.
That's right, Bob.
So how do you learn learn to act? How do you learn to be a good practicing? And I know I've asked this question before. You say that there really is no such thing. Be an ethical attorney.
I've never said there's no such thing.
Okay, I'm sorry. Maybe I misunderstood about the whole thing about legal ethics. I asked a question about legal ethics. What do they teach you in legal ethics? That's the question I asked, to be more specific. Previously, I want to know what they taught in.
Well, I mean, the best way to learn to be a good lawyer is to work under a great lawyer. I mean, that much still applies. The whole idea is, depending on what you want to do, you want to work under the best that you can be around, and let them teach you the ropes.
Well, then a lot of these Republicans should come out. They must seek out evil lawyers, I guess. You know.
No, they just seek out. I mean, they seek out people who do what they seek out people who do what they want to do. Of course, you know, there's a tremendous amount of cost associated with it all, so that a lot of people, when they come out of school, they don't have the luxury of going and doing what they feel like they're called to do. They have to go and do what will pay off the student loan debt. And I'm sure you see.
Yeah, that's a major problem. Yeah, it's Rick again. I had a client I had to get rid of there.
Oh, no worries at all. I think I've been filibustering a little bit.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool. No, yeah, you're basically right, though. I mean, it's you know, the cost of going to law school is just tremendous. I mean, when I went in like the late 80s to UCLA, that's what brought me out to California. I think the tuition was only something like $950 a semester, and I thought that was a lot of the time. Now it's like, I don't know, $20,000 a semester for in-state.
Yeah, so my cousin went to UCLA Law School and is now with one of the biggest, business. Started out being idealistic. I don't know how he became a business attorney, but anyway, he started out being a public interest lawyer. So,
well, what's that expression about whoever writes the checks determines what you believe? I'm sure you know it, Bob. It doesn't come to mind right now, but you know, for example, these quack scientists who say global warming is a hoax. You know, if you can pay somebody enough money, they'll basically believe anything that, you know, will help their pocketbook or whatever.
And if you pay somebody enough money, they will make the argument that will confirm biases in other people.
Yeah,
I mean, look at the scientists who work for the American Petroleum Institute. That one Smithsonian scientist who got stone cold busted for having all of his work underwritten by the fossil fuel industry. And then there's the guy who tried to take apart some of the mountaintop removal research and he's from Yale, no less, and he was paid by the coal industry to try to take it down. And somebody asked him why he did the work, and he said, well, I got a house payment to make.
That's true. I mean, I totally, I can see that. I mean, because you got 150, 200,000, which now I guess is that out of the ballpark for what you can get in debt. You gotta, you know, make some money, you know, to pay off the debt, and then, you get married and start having a couple of kids, and then that's just, you know, then you look at those kids, can't have them going hungry. So.
Yeah, well, you can only save the world once once your own needs are met and your family's taken care of and, you know, you're paying off your student loan, I guess, you know, unfortunately.
Hi, everybody.
Hey, Alex.
Hey, Alex, how are you?
Hey. Hi, Alex.
Hi. Yeah, you were talking about, doesn't that sound like Maslow's hierarchy of needs? If you don't get food, shelter, all the basics met, I mean, you can't really go up and be self-actualized now, can you?
No, hardly not.
Yeah, well, that's part of the plan. Not the plan, it's just the way it works out. I don't know if it's a plan per se as much, it's just the way it works out. I mean, if were some enlightened society, maybe there'd be a way to prevent that, but I don't see too many enlightened societies throughout history. I mean, do you, Bob, or any of y'all of fellow listeners?
Hornistas? Yeah, no, I don't think so. I mean, unless it's on Star Trek or something like that.
Yeah, I was just telling someone in Facebook of all the woes, you know, we were talking about all the woes of our country and the world, and I said, you know, most of the citizenry of the United States are dumber than a sack full of nails, the rest are mean-spirited and racist, and then there's us.
Did you get the sack and nails reference from Malloy?
Yes, I did.
There you go, yeah.
Yeah, but the point being, in order to recognize that the rest of us are dumber than a sack of nails, you've got to be smart enough or sophisticated enough or astute enough to recognize that fact, and how many of us really, given the nature of what we have to deal with every day, can even be that astute to realize that.
No, I meant that the people that are the others that are aware, like us, is just a small minority, and the rest are a combination of those other things.
Sad but true, I think, Alex, you know?
Hey, I got to do something for the first time in my life I've never done before.
Uh-oh.
I had to send a check to the IRS.
Oh, God.
I always had deductions taken out of a paycheck and always got refunds.
What was your damage this year, Sparky?
Oh, it was not that much.
Not that much, yeah.
$693.
Oh, God, I would trade, I would definitely trade your situation for mine any day. I'm going to owe about 16 or 17 grand.
The hardest thing to figure out is how much of your Social Security is taxable. This worksheet they give you, they make it multiply this and divide by that, then take this number and do this.
Doesn't TurboTax do that, or don't you have a computer program that does that?
I do it myself. I like the challenge.
So you have pen and paper and just do it that way, the old school way?
No, I do it on the computer.
Okay.
I use Adobe Reader, and it brings up the PDF file of a 1040, and you just type in everything on the computer, and then you print it out.
So did you mail yours in, or did you just go ahead and...
Yeah, I mailed it.
E-file it, yeah. Yeah, it's stupid to e-file if you're going to owe money. I'm just going to mail mine in. I got an extension. I couldn't bear to write such a large check.
Wow, so. That's a lot of money. You must have businesses and stuff.
I'm just an attorney. I thought I was getting a divorce earlier in the year, and so I had my withholdings decreased.
Oh.
And it turns out we got back together, sort of, kind of.
Ooh.
So that was the problem. I was expecting more deductions.
Oh.
Yeah, so I filed on extension. I'll you know, I've got to, like, we always have big medical expenses, dental expenses, so I have to, like, figure that out. I just don't have time to do that right now, so.
What kind of lawyering do you do?
I am a tax lawyer, actually.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Well, so at least you know how to do it, and right.
Right, right. I know how to screw the pooch, so to speak.
Yeah, but gone are the days of the guy getting out his shoebox full of receipts and I don't know, are they? Is that
No. We get clients all the time. We call them shoebox cases. And, you know, I just give it to a paralegal to look through, you know, because we bill at the rate of, I don't know, $450 an hour or something like that, you know. So the paralegals bill about half that rate. And so we just have the paralegal use up their time to go through the shoe boxes, so to speak, and try to figure out what evidence supports the deduction or whatever, and, you know, try to get a good deal from the government attorney. But it's kind of funny. When you're on the other side, you realize how unreasonable the government attorneys are. But when you're in a government attorney, you think you're just, you know, just dealing based on the merits of the case, and, you know, you're being totally reasonable. It's a perspective is an interesting thing.
And it does change.
Oh, yeah. You got it.
Yeah. Well, it has been, I thank you, Rick, for jumping into the conversation this evening. I hope it will not be your last time into the room.
No, I'll definitely come by.
And,
I'll have
and,
a beer
and,
next time.
And thank
nice
you.
Likewise.
Thank
likewise,
you for,
Alex.
Thank you for sacrificing your Norman Goldman time. Because, well, he does an awfully good show.
Yeah, I've got one of his podcasts, so I can actually catch up on that. But he's got a guest host anyway, so.
Ah.
Yeah, Alex, I was going to ask you real quick if I could, Bob.
Sure.
Are you based in Arizona, Stan, or where are you again?
Yeah, I'm originally from New York City, Stan. Then
yeah.
I lived in New Mexico, Stan.
Right.
Then I lived in Portland, Oregon, Stan. And
okay.
Now I'm in Arizona, Stan. I call it gun crazy Arizona, Stan.
Well, there you go. There you go. Well, you've got Senator McCain. Get out of here. What did he say? Telling the demonstrators to get the hell out of here. Something.
Yeah, I have him and that Governor Ducey, who's Governor Douche. I call him Governor Douchey.
Who makes Jan Brewer look like Bob La Follette or La Follette or whatever? Yeah. let's make it a little easier. Makes Jan Brewer look like Hubert Humphrey.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, no, we do have to get out of here because, and I apologize for the late start of the program, but you'll have that. But thanks, everybody, for sticking around and being part of the conversation. Thank you to Jan and Jerry, and thank you to our buddy Sal for helping out this evening. It was much appreciated. Thank you, everybody, in the chat room for participating. Thank you on the Gizmo line to Jim. Thanks to Alex. Good to hear from you. Thank you, Jeffrey and Rick and Carol Abel and Steve. Thank you, Waggy, and thank you, Larry, and thanks, of course, always to longtime Horn Malloy Skype chat room moderator Sparky. It's a rousing, good little conversation that we have here. And thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks to all of you who keep the horn going and have kept it going for oh so many years. It's the only reason we're still on the air. And, of course, thank you to our all-volunteer staff. Thank you to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and acact.org. And, yes, always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Have a happy weekend, everybody. Bye now.